Welcome, welcome from Alpha, to Omega.
Hello, and welcome to the 70th episode of From Alpha to Omega. Today is Friday the 15th of July, and my broadband has finally been fixed. I'm delighted to welcome Alexander Douglas, a lecturer in philosophy at St. Andrews University, to the show to talk about his recent book, The Philosophy of Debt. I had a great talk with Alex about the nature of debt and money, and how all this stuff is explicitly linked to the power relations and class structure of our society. We also got to talk about how this MMT stuff can be viewed or fits in from a Marxist point of view, a synthesis of both, which I think could be extremely fruitful. But before all of that nice stuff, I have a few people to thank. First off, the once-off donor, Ryan G, and all the monthly subscribers, Gaurav Mahagiv. I also must thank the unfortunate souls who have subscribed on YouTube, Duck Ann, David Dixon, Spectre of Marx, Oscar von Hauske, Rick Larson, Daniel Cowan, Ryan Gott, Katie Bay, Pat Crowley, DDSW, Mach C1234 Golf, RTR Truth Media, Igorka 2201, Suhaib Shekfe, and Brendan Dupuyer Moore. Thanks all for subscribing. If you like the show, please like, subscribe, share, leave a review on iTunes and all that jazz. It really helps spread the word. You can also check out the show's Facebook group and the Twitter page. Now, to the interview. So, Alex, how did you end up getting into all of this debt and MMT stuff?
Well, I was always interested, well, not always, but I became interested in heterodox economics in general long before the financial crisis. I read some of the kind of, I think I read some John Kenneth Galbraith stuff and was surprised to see this discussion of economics that didn't try to force any of the insights into the models, the textbook models that were presented. And I became interested in that, but I found it quite...
So what do you mean by that? Sorry.
Well, first of all, the idea that there was economics written in prose was new to me, I think. And I just discovered this stuff, that there were descriptions of what actually happens in business meetings, that there were descriptions of how political decisions are actually taken rather than just some kind of reaction function that's supposed to output the decision. And then I became interested in things like Joan Robinson, logical examinations of the concepts that get used innocently by these neoclassical economists, things like capital and labor. But I found that all sort of negative. I mean, it is a good stick to beat neoclassical economists with, if you like, to say, well, can you define that term? And, you know, how do you deal with this particular logical problem arising out of the Cambridge capital controversy? But that's really just a way of snapping at their heels. Well, that's how I came to see it anyway. So finding MMT was interesting because it gave these much more direct policy recommendations. It seemed to have a much more positive kind of framework in that it wasn't just a way of presenting skepticism about what the outcome of a certain decision might be. It could actually generate recommendations.
So more policy, less critique?
I think so, yeah. It seemed, it was, you know, a bit more, lends itself to reformist activism, if not activism at the grassroots level. And that is something that interested me.
You say reformist activism. What do you mean by that now?
It struck me as the kind of thing that you could present to a fairly centrist politician, for example, and hope to get some traction, whether or not you see that as a legitimate political intervention. It struck me as something that MMT has going for it. But I suppose I was interested philosophically when I read an article in The Economist, it must have been not long after the crisis. Well, it probably was quite a while after, 2010 maybe. It was just on Heterodox Economics, and it was talking about how the crisis had revived Heterodox Economics to a certain extent. And it mentioned this guy called Warren Mosler, and made him, it painted quite a complimentary picture, but left open the possibility that he was just a crank. And so I thought, I was intrigued, and I thought I would check it out. And I watched him on Fox News, because that was the first thing that came up, was a video of him being interviewed on Fox News. And he started off, to me, sounding like a crank, until he said something like, well, remember that government bonds are just savings accounts at the Fed. And that made me sort of jump up from my seat, because I'd just never thought of it like that. And it was this very simple philosophical point that even as somebody who likes to think about these things philosophically, I mean, I like to explore these concepts, it had just never occurred to me to think, well, what is the difference between a bond issued by the Treasury and a savings account, which is just a liability of the central bank? It had never crossed my mind. And so I suppose that's probably when I started thinking about the concepts like debt and like what an asset is and what it means to hold an asset. I suppose that was where I began. So MMT was primarily a philosophical interest to me, I think, before it had any interest for me in terms of policy recommendations and things like that.
So your book from last year, The Philosophy of Debt, you do a philosophical analysis of debt. Can you talk about this a bit?
Well, following on from this point about bonds, I guess the question that I asked myself was why does that seem plausible, and why does it seem weird at the same time? So the reason it seems weird is because if you're educated in the mainstream of economics, or even in a lot of heterodox traditions, it's just obvious that, no, a bond is a debt marker. It's a certificate of a debt from the government to you. It's something completely different from the thing that's actually owed, right? It specifies that you're owed a certain amount of currency, but it isn't the currency. And I thought that what seems to be happening there is we think about debt intuitively in terms of these close to home examples, because these are the things that we kind of grow up with. All of these questions of financial assets and things like this are introduced much later. But when we begin, we think of simple cases like I borrow your lawnmower and there's no debt marker at all there, but maybe I could write out a debt marker for you. I could say I owe you a lawnmower. And it's very obvious there that there's one object in the world that I owe you. And then you have this debt marker, which is just your claim on that one object. That's nice and simple. You have to build up a very long way before you get to something like a government bond. But that one complexity you could then introduce as well, suppose your lawnmower is destroyed somehow in an accident. You might say, well, okay, now I owe you a lawnmower, but the what I call, using a bit of medieval logic, the suppositio of the term, it has now changed. The term, the thing that I owed you used to refer to one particular object. Now it's a kind of distributive term. There's some lawnmower out there that I owe you. It's got to be one of a class of certain lawnmowers which are equivalent in value or something like that. But that is now looking like a very different sort of relationship. And I think what I realized when I thought about what Mosler had said is, what if the class of objects you could present to extinguish the liability includes the debt marker itself? That seems to be what's happening with a government bond. So a government bond says you have a claim on any risk-free financial asset worth this amount, but of course that bond itself is a risk-free financial asset worth that amount. It's a perfectly liquid financial asset. It serves the same purpose. And I think that's when I realized that what Mosler was doing was not just economics. He was making this interesting philosophical intervention.
So that's quite a tricky concept. So that the government bond, it's not a debt, but it represents something that's equivalent to a debt.
Well, the weird thing about it is it's a debt, but also the thing that extinguishes the debt. in that sense. I mean, the thing that the only way that the state, and this gets into the question of amalgamating the treasury and the central bank, but in principle, the only thing that with a fiat currency, the only thing that the state can use to extinguish any of its debts is other liabilities. It's liabilities of the. So, I mean, the Bank of England can. You can use Bank of England notes to repay the debt that's supposedly embodied in a government bond, but Bank of England notes are liabilities of the Bank of England, which are in turn backed by government debt, at least nominally. So the government seems to be extinguishing the debt with its own debt. And that, I mean, that's why we have so much trouble making sense out of what's going on here. And there are two dimensions to that. One is the financial accounting, which, of course, you can just learn. But the other is morally how we should think about this. You know, the morals of the lawnmower case seem so benignly intelligible by comparison. It's pretty clear there, you know, what we should think. It's pretty clear that if I just walk away with the lawnmower and never return it to you, I'm doing something wrong, I'm harming you. But when we get to these cases where the relation between the thing owed and the marker of the debt and the two agents involved in the process is so completely just loopy, it's no longer possible to just apply our moral intuitions in this straightforward way.
So the way I like to think about, say, the government debt or the government currency, I just deal with the government debt and the government currency as the same thing. One is like an interest-bearing currency and one is like just a bog-standard currency. But to me, it's such a strange thing that we can say that they can just print up new money. But when they print up this new money, correct me now if I'm wrong, the way I look at it is that this currency that I'm printing up is this in a kind of a classical economic sense. It seems to me that this currency allows labor to be done. So, for example, if I'm unemployed and there's a government jobs scheme and they pay me, you know, 20 grand a year just to do something, printing that money and paying it to me will allow me to be able to create things that have a certain value. And it's like it allows value to be created. So even though it looks kind of like it's very circular when we look at how the government debt works on its own, but it's what the printing of this money or the government debt, creation of the government debt kind of brings into being that allows it to extinguish itself.
I think that's absolutely right. I mean, the question that we need to start with is what is it that makes something money? And I mean, Warren says that we should just avoid the term money because it's so vexed and so complicated. And I find it very interesting that in economics textbooks, you're sometimes just introduced this concept, money, which is maybe given these various roles, it's a medium of exchange, etc. None of them seem necessary or sufficient to define something as money. Joan Robinson pointed out a long time ago in a barter society, if somebody barters one object for another object which they don't actually want, but they just keep it. So I might, I don't know, barter a, I'm a blacksmith, I'll barter a hammer to you for some corn. I just hold on to the corn, not because I want to eat it, but because I know that somebody else will probably give up something that I do want for it. That shouldn't be sufficient to make corn into money, because people do that with objects all the time. I mean, you know, you kind of constantly swapping for things. You might be in a barter society, just swapping for things that you just want to hang on to. So you need something else. And then all these other conditions, store of value, etc., they don't seem to work either, because the same argument can just be applied. So in economics textbooks, you're then given these sorts of pyramid, or there are these different money things which variously approximate to the condition of money. So cash is, you know, sort of ultimate. That's definitely money. And then you have these different sorts of financial assets, and you've got corporate paper and government bonds fit somewhere in there. This strikes me as just a useless way of trying to throw any light on any of the important issues. And I think what you've just suggested there is, of course, what we're interested in is the sorts of social relations you can create, the sort of relation of power you can use this thing to create. Surely that's got to be the relevant feature of defining something as money.
That's a very deep point, that the nature of money is intrinsically tied to the social relations in the society.
Yeah. I mean, it's something that
It sounds a bit too Marxist to be in a in an economics textbook.
Well, I guess that's right. But it's interesting if you look at the history of discussions of money to most of the medieval tradition, this was just an obvious point that, of course, money is a sort of political contract at some level. Because otherwise it's impossible to see what could distinguish it from mere commodity, I think, anyway. So, it is a Marxist point insofar as it's in Marx, but I think that it's also the point that almost anyone will arrive at if they think of money in any degree of philosophical depth rather than just wanting to have something to stick in as the value of a certain variable in an economic model.
I made that kind of point about the Marxists. It's kind of ironic, which is a point, you know, I think we probably both agree on, is that Marxists have what we would call a very commodity money type concept.
Yeah, I think that that's right. And that is a problem, I guess. So the MMT way of thinking about money, and to me, you know, there are bits of MMT that I'm just not sure about, but the MMT view of money, you've had Randall Ray on here before, at least he says this directly. He just agrees with Minsky that anybody can create money. The problem is getting it accepted. And so his point is just, well, I can issue, you know, IOUs. I could issue my own bonds and see if I can get them to circulate, see if I can purchase things by issuing debt certificates. And if people circulate them around, then, you know, why aren't they money? There's a tricky philosophical point there, because is it the thing is money and then you have to get it accepted, or does it become money when you have the power to get it accepted? I think that's the crucial point here. And maybe this is something that isn't sufficiently taken note of in the Marxist literature. I just don't know it well enough. But with government money, with currency, the story is quite simple. You impose a tax liability first, and then you can choose what that tax liability is denominated in, and then people will have to give up things, at least to you, to get the thing that extinguishes that tax liability. Otherwise, you'll subject them to punishments. So in that case, it's obvious what makes something money. So if that's what we mean by money, if we're taking currency as the paradigm of money, then the only question you have to ask is, well, how much power, how much coercive power backs the asset that you're circulating? And then the answer to that question will determine how much we should classify that asset as money.
It seems that power and money and debt seem to be inextricably linked. Would you go so far as to say power is the root?
I think so. Yeah. I mean, the idea of a commodity, I'm also just not sure about whether there is a coherent account of what a commodity is either. But the idea of a commodity is that it's something that's desired for its value in use, what Smith would call its value in use. And so the idea of a commodity money is, well, in addition to the value in use, it has to develop some value in exchange, which isn't just reducible to somebody else's desire to use it for, you know, to just extract utility from it. And I can't see what that could be except for power. So if I start telling everybody that they have to turn over green flowers to me or I'll subject them to punishments, well, then green flowers will start to circulate and they'll stop being commodities. The problem with that distinction is that, of course, the whole exchange economy is infected with these relations of power. You know, I mean, there is no hard line between a voluntary exchange and a coerced exchange. So that's where the issue becomes tricky. Maybe that's why Marxists don't distinguish between commodities and money in the way that MMT would.
Can you talk then about this job guarantee that a lot of MMT people are quite hot on?
Sure. So the question, again, it all stems, and I'm not sure that all of the MMT people have been clear enough on spelling this out. It all stems from the question of what a currency is. So I think the mainstream view is that, look, the currency is just this convenient medium of exchange. It reduces transaction costs, and the government supplies the currency, or the central bank, whoever supplies the currency, just as a kind of public service. People now have this medium of exchange. And the thing that's weird about that is, again, it's the Minsky point. If we need media of exchange, you know, why can't we just create them ourselves? And it seems that there's a tension here between, which is also what mainstream economists say when they do tell a historical story, that we just sort of develop these media of exchange. Okay, well, then why do we need the government to come and issue them? The MMT story is, it's the creation of a state currency doesn't begin with the printing of an asset and circulating of the asset. It begins with the creation of a liability that wasn't there before. So what you do is you just impose this tax liability. And for MMT, that's the source of unemployment. So I mean, their model is the hut tax. In places like Mashonaland and other places, there are British colonies in Africa. So the idea there is you go from a village that's has zero unemployment. Whether or not you want to call it fully employed, I think is tricky, because you might want to say that, well, unemployment is very specifically, it's not just deprivation. A person who's starving on a desert island, you know, it would be weird to call that person unemployed. Unemployment is a sort of a power relation. It's a situation in which people need to offer their labor in order to acquire a particular sort of asset, I mean, in order to acquire currency. So you go into a village where it's perfectly self-sufficient, and then you impose a tax liability on all the huts, which can only be paid in something that only you have, which is shillings. It goes from zero unemployment to mass unemployment overnight. As soon as you've done that, you've created the currency. You don't even need to print the shillings, right? I mean, you have unemployment there because you have people who are offering their labor because they have no choice to try to earn these shillings to keep themselves out of prison. You already have the currency there. And whether or not you print the shillings just depends on, you know, how sadistic you want to be. And so the job guarantee is just a way of saying, well, since you've created all this unemployment, the least you could do is now provide the means of extinguishing it.
So give somebody a job.
Yeah, I mean, you know, people should at least have the chance to earn the shillings that you've created the demand for simply by imposing this tax that's payable in them. I mean, I think so the difference between full employment as recommended by mainstream economists and full employment as recommended by MMTers is mainstream economists sort of tend to think unemployment is this naturally occurring phenomenon, and the government can try to do something about this naturally occurring phenomenon. Whereas the MMT view is, no, the government created all the unemployment, so the job guarantee is simply a way of reversing the imposition that it's placed upon society.
It's a very counterintuitive way of looking at it, that unemployment is created by the government.
Yeah, it is. So, I mean, there's a talk that Mosler gives where he starts off by saying, what's the purpose of taxation? And of course, everybody gets it wrong. You know, they think, well, it's to bring in revenue for government. He deals with that easily. He's saying, well, government's the only issuer of the currency, so how could it possibly need revenue paid in that currency? And the answer that he ends up with is the purpose of taxation is to create unemployment. That's the primary purpose. That's what taxation is for.
So it creates unemployment. And so the taxation, in effect, forces people to work that is deemed meaningful socially.
That's right. Yeah. I mean, it's a way of...
It's quite a coercive. It's coercive when you think about its root nature.
It's fundamentally coercive. Yeah. And it's not just about coercing labor. I mean, it's about creating a certain structure of labor. So if you can imagine a society, I mean, the problem is, you know, other society, you don't want to compare our society with its coercive apparatus to some idealized version of our society where you just take the coercive apparatus away. And that's where the myth of barter comes from in economics textbooks. You think, well, just take a society like ours and just take the money away. It's like, well, then, I mean, you're taking away the entire coercive apparatus of our society. Whether you're left with anything that would even be logically conceivable, shouldn't just be something you can assume. But imagine some other sort of society where you don't have money, you don't have a state currency like this. People will still work to produce what they need. They'll still work for each other, maybe. But it won't all have to be channeled through this single medium. What I mean is, if I'm hungry and I go down to Sainsbury's, I can only give them money. I can't give them anything else. I can't use my labor in any other way to procure what I need from Sainsbury's. So first of all, I have to find somebody who will exchange my labor for currency. So there's a whole structuring of labor relations that occurs because people say that currency is a way of overcoming the inconveniences of barter, but in a way you could say, well, it adds all these inconveniences, right? It might be the case that otherwise I would have been able to go to Sainsbury's and say, look, I'll stack your shelves for an hour and let me take home a couple of burgers or something. But I can't do that because money is in the way and currency is in the way.
What are the political implications then of a job guarantee? You know, if it's changing this nature of the coercion so much.
Yeah, I think that this is something that, again, mainstream economists like Simon Wren-Lewis, for example, engage with MMT, I remember him saying something like, well, why isn't this just mainstream macroeconomics? I mean, mainstream macroeconomics acknowledges that the government, the combination of fiscal and monetary policy can always eliminate unemployment if it wants to. How is this different? And I guess one way in which it's different is because you're looking directly at the coercive element of unemployment, that unemployment has to be something that you impose upon a society by coercing it. And yeah, then you can recognize the thing that Michael Kaletsky was trying to talk about in his 1943, I think, article, Political Aspects of Full Employment. What happens is you have socialized the power to coerce labor. That's effectively what you've done. So the easiest way to think about it is to go back to the hut tax. If you go to the hut tax and every hut has this tax liability, and then I give all the shillings to maybe three or four guys, okay, well now I've outsourced my power to coerce labor. I've deputized it. Now those guys get to decide how they want to use all the labor that there is. Whereas if I have a standing offer that anybody who doesn't like the terms that those three guys offer can come directly to me, now I'm the government in this example, then you've got a socialized system of labor. So it is very significant.
I suppose it depends on what the government is structured like and what their jobs are going to be like.
Yeah, I think that's right. I mean, if you have a government that is basically just another capitalist, that's basically just having a very rich capitalist, an infinitely wealthy capitalist. So you've got all these different people who've got these savings of currency, which various people need because of tax liabilities. They might not have tax liabilities themselves, but again, you know, the reason I need to pay currency to Sainsbury's to get food is because Sainsbury's has taxes that can only be paid in currency. Then, yeah, if you treat the government as just one big capitalist, then the only difference is that it has an infinite supply of this currency because it has the monopoly power to issue it, whereas the other capitalists only have as much currency as they've accumulated.
One thing that always strikes me about this MNT understanding of monetary policy and the currency, it seems to me that the people in power, say, you know, politicians and probably the central bankers, I think they know all of this stuff personally. Because if we go back to, say, something like, say, World War II, and we look at what America or Britain did, you know, they didn't say, oh, Germany's attacking me, we don't have enough money to build planes or whatever. They just expanded the monetary base up until everybody was employed to defend the nation and create all the tanks and planes and everything that they needed. They didn't give a damn about the debt.
Yeah, I think that's absolutely right. And I find that people are often insiders are cagey about admitting how much they actually do or don't agree with this understanding of the issue. So I'm sure you know there's a famous interview with Samuelson where he said what he says about the deficit as well. It's just a noble lie, basically, that you want to act as if the government's overspend is some sort of borrowing operation, because otherwise it's completely unconstrained in how much it can overspend from year to year. You know, once people realize that issuing bonds is really just the same as issuing currency, the government can just do whatever it likes. And so somehow this false perception serves some important political purpose by reigning in the government. But as you say, I mean, does it? As you've given the clear example there, Britain is running a deficit in 1941. Germany's on the verge of invading. Does Churchill surrender because he can't afford to pay for the soldiers? And the, I mean, this noble lie seems to kind of come and go as it pleases the governing authorities to be subject to it. So who is it constraining, I guess, is my question. I mean, it clearly doesn't seem to be constraining the decision makers, since they can give up on it whenever they like. It only constrains the population. But why do we need to constrain the population? I mean, we already have the legal system and the police to do that.
So this seems to really tie into as well a thing of class and power. Kaleski, in the essay you mentioned, the political aspects of full employment, I think it's called. What are the problems that he envisages with trying to introduce this guarantee of full employment?
Well, Kaleski's idea is that capitalism has evolved into a system where unemployment is a crucial disciplinary measure in the relation between labor and capital. That, you know, you can sort of speculate on what would happen if that were no longer there, in the same way that you could speculate on what would happen if prison sentences were abolished or something like that. But we just don't know. To not be able to implicitly threaten workers at the bottom, the workers who are really as close as you can get to the threat of unemployment, would change the whole nature of the factory. It's just unclear that it would be able to be run in anything like the way that it's currently run. That was his main concern. So he said the reason why fascism had no problem implementing full employment in Germany is because it did just completely change the nature of the power structure of society. You know, it didn't have to worry about how things would play out now that these power imbalances had been completely reversed, because it sought to do that in the first place. And that was the point of fascism.
I mentioned before to Randall Ray about, you know, the Nazis essentially introduced MMT to get them out of the Great Depression. I don't know what they called that at the time. I think it was called Chartism back in the day. But they used it to guarantee full employment. They brought their unemployment rates down from, like, I think, you know, 30% down to 2% in a matter of 5 or 6 years.
Yeah. I mean, mind you, any nation that goes to war brings its unemployment rate down to basically full employment levels as well. So, yeah, it's certainly possible.
So here we are now in 2016, and we have the effects of our Great Recession, or whatever people want to call it, 2008 crisis. And it's kind of ironic that we see high unemployment in a lot of nations. Some of these things are to do with the structure of the euro, which is all linked into this kind of stuff anyway, but also high unemployment in places. I know official employment is low in America, but in reality, there's a lot of unemployment.
Yeah.
And we see the resurgence of essentially a new form of charitalism. Do you think there is a chance that we might see another form of MMT-style policies being put into place, given the class relations, you know, the split of both the right and the left parties? See, in America, we've got the Republican split and we've got the Democrat split. And in England, we've got the Tory split and we've got the Labour Party split, mostly along the similar lines.
Yeah. So here's where I think the Kaleski article is important, because the full employment policies that were pursued in the 60s and 70s were aggregate demand management policies. So you would just kind of pump as much money into the economy as you could, in the hope that at some point the opportunity cost, the economic opportunity cost of not hiring any available labor, would fall so low as to make it irrational for a capitalist not to do that. And Kaleski's point is, well, that's assuming that they're motivated by purely pecuniary concerns. But of course, what the capitalist realizes is that, as I said, unemployment is a useful disciplinary possibility, right? So capitalists might be willing to pay for it, in the sense it doesn't matter how low the opportunity cost of not hiring labor goes. You know, there's just a certain amount that they're allocating to pay or to not maximize their profits in order to maintain that power, which might be vital to the functioning of, at least at that point, industrial capitalism. So there's this in the UK. There are bad associations with full employment policy, because I think people, to some extent rightly, blame it for all the industrial conflict that emerged after that period. You basically had this kind of attempt to subvert an existing power balance that didn't quite work out. Yeah, you end up with these pitched battles between representatives of different industrial interests. The job guarantee idea is, well, okay, fine, so don't work within the market, right? You just circumvent the market entirely. Instead of trying to incentivize capitalists to hire all the available labor, we'll just hire them ourselves. We, the government, will just hire them ourselves. Well, of course, that's even more radical. So I don't know. I mean, you know, well, there are two possibilities. One way is to kind of try to smuggle it in as not that great a departure from the current way of operating, which I think is how a lot of MMT activists are kind of presenting it. It's like, look, you know, this is just the logical extension of kind of Keynesian demand management. The other is to show it for what it really is, in which case it takes on a pretty revolutionary character, I think.
Yeah, it seems to me to be quite radical. I suppose I would say, like, that, you know, it depends on who's running the government. You know, like, if you have a fascist run the government, it's kind of radical, but not in the right way, you know?
Yeah. So the question is, you know, as a person who only has your labor power to offer, you're a mendicant, and who are you a mendicant to? The job guarantee just means you no longer can possibly be a mendicant to private interest, because if you don't like the terms any of them offer you, you can always get these guaranteed fixed terms, you know, a fixed living wage by working for the state. And so, I mean, this is a philosophical question. It's not obvious that that's better, right? I mean, you know, there's all the debates about state socialism then need to be had to promote the policy in that way, which I guess is why people are trying to say, well, look, it's really just more expansionary sort of fiscal policy, or it's a way of extending things we already have. It's a way of extending the auto stabilizers and stuff like that. But of course, you know, I think it's not. I think it inevitably has to be more radical than.
You know, I think, you know, if the people in power are aware of it and they know the reality of what it'll mean from their experience of the 70s and the 60s, when labor, you know, the capitalist class thought labor was getting too uppity because the power relations were changed, when they could, full employment policies meant people could just not put up with the crap, say, of one capitalist and always nearly be guaranteed a job. That it just seems like you should talk about it in its reality, because the people who say the capitalist class, they will understand its reality because they saw some of its effect on their class relations before.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I think that the problem is within the realm of mainstream politics, there's this idea that there's this dimension you can run along with kind of full state socialism on one end and a completely free market on the other. I don't think that there's any such single dimension. And so it's hard to even ask what it would mean to say that this would be more or less state socialist in the situation we have. I mean, you give a very clear example. In the 70s, I mean, so you have to go back to the point that the state just sets the price of its currency. It sets the price of its currency by determining how much of the currency you need, which ultimately comes down to the tax liabilities and what you have to do to get the currency. During the 70s, arguably, you had labor governments who were willing to accommodate the increasing wage bargains of unionized labor. So in that sense, they were just looking after their interests. And the idea is that, you know, in the 1980s, you had this move towards free markets. But in what sense? I mean, a bank is just a deputized issuer of state currency. I can, you know, talk about why that is, but I'm sure you've got other podcasts that explain why that is. The bank is just a deputized issuer of state currency. And when the Bank of England places certain loans to buy certain sorts of assets on its eligible collateral list, it's guaranteeing the prices of those assets. And so it does that with housing. And so you get this increase in house prices, which is completely state engineered in no less a sense than the increase in wages of unionized labor was state engineered. You just have a different government looking after the interests of a different class, but the technique is exactly the same. So I'm not sure what people...
This idea of the free market it's very far from what people think.
Yeah.
So people think that a rise in house prices is just some strange occurrence, but it's a planned class relation. You know, they're trying to, say, redistribute a percentage of the social production to certain classes.
Yeah, yeah. And it goes directly through the financial system, which is a public institution. It might not look that way, but it is, because the Sterling framework is a government-instituted framework, unelected central bankers, but it's still a state institution. And the Sterling framework just determines which assets are going to move where, because it puts some on its collateral list and it doesn't put others on. So I think that there's very few people in the UK who are thinking of politics like that. I think that anybody is kind of a starting assumption that, well, of course, the 80s were the free market years, and before that was the state socialist years. I think to get any traction on this debate, you'd have to first disabuse people of that.
Also, as part of your book, you have a chapter on, say, Marxism and the falling rate of profit.
Yeah.
Which is, I find very interesting, because I'm consider myself some kind of strange MMT/Marxist hybrid. So it seems to me that there is an obvious, I would think, a deficiency in most Marxist thinking, understanding of currency and its class relations. Like, if we had taken the word Keynesian and stuff like this out of our conversation now and people to listen to it, we talk so much about power and class, people would probably think it was a Marxist talk.
Yeah.
And MMT is really from an entirely different school of thought. Personally, it seems to me like that there's a large hole in Marxism that doesn't understand this. It's strange. It doesn't seem to understand the real functioning of currency.
Okay. So it depends on how we're measuring profit. And again, this comes back to the sort of Cambridge capital controversies. It's the sort of thing that Joan Robinson discusses in her book on Marx. If you take a neoclassical view where just forget about money, I mean, money, if anything, is a useful numerator, but that's not what we're reckoning any of our quantities in terms of. We're reckoning in terms of labor power or something. Then you might be able to argue that there's an inevitable tendency for the rate of profit to fall if the government at least pursues a consistent policy or something like that. I mean, I'm never quite sure what the government is doing in this situation. But if you're doing something like Clyman does, and you're actually measuring the rate of profit in terms of currency, well, he himself says that, look, the rate of profit, the decline can be obscured by leverage, financial leverage by companies. They sort of get these temporary record profits based on valuations, based on loans that are never actually going to be paid off, impossible loans. Because the government can just make this impossible loan to itself indefinitely. It can roll over forever. So you can't say that there's some tendency of the rate of profit measured in money terms to fall when you've got a state that has complete control over its fiscal policy.
I have this like dichotomy of where I can see things from a value point of view and it to make sense to me. And then I see things from the MMT point of view and that makes sense. And logically, I find it very hard to understand what there seems to be a contradiction.
Yeah, I'm just confused about that. I think that trying to think in terms of value is just such a logical nightmare that I don't know how to pass something like that.
This idea, like this idea of the rate of profit as a, you know, links back to the ratio between this increase in how much machinery there is compared to a human.
Yeah.
And that's, it's undeniable that this is always increasing, pretty much. The cost in general is always increasing. So it just seems that to me it's an undeniable fact that this is the nature of capitalist production. But in a scenario where we have, say, companies, say, that are making a profit of 10% or 5%, and they look like they're going to go bust, and a government can issue some currency and buy stuff from that company to keep it afloat. It just seems to me, I don't understand what happens to, I can see that that company won't go bust.
Yeah.
That you could organize a situation where all these companies don't go bust. But I don't understand what that means with respect to the value relations. There's a crux there where I never feel like I can combine the two, if you will, kind of schemas or worldviews.
Yeah, I mean, so this is, I mean, I've never thought about, this is just something that's just occurred to me, so if it's complete nonsense, then I plead indulgence here. I guess you could say, so the proposition is that there's an increase in the ratio of fixed to variable capital. And what are you measuring those in terms of? Well, you're supposed to be measuring them in terms of hours of socially average labor time or something like that. And you might just park the Joan Robinson critique of, you know, you don't have a unit there, right? You don't have something that is actually going to function as a unit of measure. I mean, maybe you do, maybe you don't. I don't know. That's way outside of my remit. But you're saying, look, there's some intuitive sense in which there's some sort of tendency there that looks plain to see. There's a capital deepening that's going on. Well, one thing you might think is competition is playing a vital role there, and there's exactly as much competition as the state decides for there to be at the end. So that, again, looks contingent on state policy. You might say that there's an inevitability for the interests of capital to capture state policy or something like that. But that's one problem. But another problem which I just thought of is that the whole point of a job guarantee is to deal with this capital deepening problem. That effectively what you're doing is, okay, well, if businesses are moving to less and less labor-intensive forms of production, the state just takes over all the workers and designs socially important things for them to do. So it designs things that are deliberately labor intensive, because that's the whole point, is to maximize the use of labor. Would that work against the tendency of the rate of profit to fall, as the way you've described it? I don't know.
This is the thing I always feel about, say, this MMT way of looking at currency. Like, the way I like to think about it sometimes, and I do not know if this makes any sense, is that, say, if we have a falling, like, Kleinman and Marxists make the, well, Marxists who believe in the falling rate of profit as a real thing, make this point that, you know, if the average rate of profit of a company is 20%, and if there's some noise around that 20%, so some do 30%, some do 10%, some do 80% profit, some do minus 40% profit. At 20%, say, most firms are safe, because it's pretty hard to be unlucky enough to make a loss, say.
Yeah, yeah.
And then you get down, this falling rate of profit starts kicking in, you know, over the decades and decades and decades. And then, say, you're down to an average rate of 5% rate of profit.
Yeah.
And then it's much easier to just to be a bit unlucky, and you go into negative profit, and then you go bust. That if we are using state policy to, say, deficit spend or whatever way we want to do it, to keep the profits of these companies working and above a loss, that as capital gets closer and closer to this, you know, zero profit robot controlled world, that the amount of production that's paid for, it won't be coming from private means. It'll be coming from state means, say, you know, as a proportion of all the money that's spent, it will go to state means. So that if we use MMT in a capitalist system, like, the kind of logical endpoint, if the rate of profit is true, which I think is true on its own side, is like, then you end up in a kind of a state socialism.
Right. Yeah, I see. Yeah.
So the logical conclusion of MMT is state socialism.
Yeah. I mean, I think that's probably right. If you combine, say, Kleinman's theory of how the falling rate of profit actually functions, which financial crisis is, I think, I mean, you can correct me if I'm wrong on this, or he can, but financial crisis is playing a necessary causal role there. And then you take Warren Mosler's claim that there's no financial crisis so large that a fiscal expansion can't just cancel it out. Right, and then you combine those two insights and you get to the point that, okay, well, if each financial crisis is reducing the share of private ownership and increasing the share of public ownership because of these fiscal expansions, then, yeah, you arrive at state socialism, I guess. That's an argument that somebody could make. I think that, I mean...
It's like communism through the back door.
Well, yeah,
or whatever you want to call it, but that's the idea I always have, and it's like,
okay, but I mean, so the idea there is, look, you've got these businesses, these corporations that finance themselves mostly through retained earnings, and then external finance is always available to them, and the state can supply as much or as little of that external finance as it wants, and control businesses in that way. Whether or not there's a falling rate of profit, I mean, isn't that already true? So the state, if it wants, can just pick winners. If it wants, you know, everything to be owned by Apple, it could probably bring that about.
Yeah, so it seems like that you know, let's assume that you have this deficit spending and say it goes to, you know, 100% of all of it ends up being state basically deciding the production on which firms. But the problem you have then is that it depends on what your state is like. That, yeah. You know, so if you had Hitler running the state, you're going to have a nasty ass state. And if you have somebody else running the state, or how democratic it is, that you still have, you've changed the relation, but you know, you change it in some nature, but it still depends on who controls the state in some way.
I mean, I guess my point is that it's unclear how that would be state socialism in any sense in which what we currently have isn't already state socialism.
What do you mean by that? Like,
well, so what investments you can make as a, you know, an individual investor, as a firm, is dependent on what sources of finance you can get. Well, to go to a bank where you can get a much better rate than if you go to private equity, you are going to a source of public finance, effectively. I mean, so if a bank makes a loan to me to start my business for £3 million, the bank is, in the first instance, just overdrawn in its reserve account at the Bank of England. The Bank of England then has a political decision and say, are we okay with the fact that this loan has been made? Do we want to, you know, punish the bank for having done that? Do we want to set an example of the bank by shutting it down and saying, you know, this is what happens if you make these sorts of loans, or do we just want to allow it? And if they allow it, then the overdraft just stays there and the bank might have to go on the, you know, interbank market to close its overdraft or whatever, but then it's been permitted. So in a way, every investment decision gets filtered through this state institution, except for a little bit of private equity. So it seems like we already have a state apparatus which decides who gets to do what, who gets to build what, who gets to buy what. It's just we don't see it because it's been deputized into all of these public-private partnerships.
You know, I think as well for, say, Marxists, I think there's an... Well, I think they're missing a beat. I think there's kind of an ideological unwillingness to deal with the implications of it.
I guess, I mean, MMT in a way is the most political approach that I've seen, in that it doesn't assume anything about what political decisions will be made. And it seems to, I mean, it's, you know, everything in the economy is determined by these political decisions. Get taken is just completely open.
Yeah, it leaves them open, but it shows how they operate. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
You know, it's kind of neutral politically, you know, but that's nearly the power of it.
Yeah, I wish I'd said that, actually. I mean, I think that MMT is desperately incomplete until it's combined with a theory of politics. And I think that's what we kept running up against in that discussion is, yeah, okay, so now we know that all of these things that we thought were kind of economic laws of necessity and just played themselves out like natural phenomena are in fact political decisions. But well, how do political decisions get taken? How can we, you know, what sorts of institutions can we expect to be able to build to take these decisions in a different way? I mean, nobody knows that. economists don't have any expertise for determining that. And I guess that was Kolesky's point as well.
Well, Alexander, thanks very much for coming on the show today.
Thank you, Tom, and thank you for allowing me to come on. Not coercing me off.
On this episode, you heard the theme tune, The Order of the Pharaonic Jesters, by Sun Ra and his orchestra, and you are now listening to Pipe Eye with People Move Along. Thanks for listening, and I hope you join me for the next episode of From Alpha to Omega. And remember, please like, subscribe, share, or leave a review over on iTunes.